Turning points change the course of our lives, whether it's a big decision, overcoming an obstacle or tragedy, or taking a leap of faith. These stories of inspiration and resilience are what Turning Point is all about. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Turning Point. I'm your host, Priya Sam, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Mira Estrada. Mira is the founder of Fuja Media, a media company engaged in digital lifestyle publishing catered to the South Asian Canadian community. Her story is featured in a book called Untold, Defining Moments of the Uprooted, where Mira talks about her turning point, coming out as an untouchable in the Hindu caste system, and the experiences that followed suit. We will hear much more about that today. Thank you so much for being here on Turning Point, Mira.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad we're having this chat.
Yeah, me too. You know, it's a topic we certainly don't hear a lot about in the mainstream media. And I actually really only heard about the experiences that Canadians were having with this from your experience. So maybe we can actually start with the caste system itself and, you know, what that is for people who might not have heard of it before.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, the Hindu caste system probably dates back thousands of years. And what it was back then was basically there was four groups. So there was the Brahmins, who were the priests and the teachers. Then there was the Kshatriyas, who were the warriors. And then there was the Vaishyas and the Shudras. And so those were the four groups of people. But then there was this other group, a subgroup, which was outside of that caste system because they were considered such low people, who were the ones who did the labor, like cleaning the toilets and that type of work, that they were considered untouchable, or as we now call them, Dalits, which means the broken ones.
And I guess that when we think about the caste system, I think the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people is that, like, oh, that was something that existed before, but it doesn't exist now. But it sounds like that's not true. And in fact, that it exists in countries that a lot of people from India, for example, have immigrated to as well.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, caste has followed them. And I get really frustrated when I hear people say, oh, no, that's something that's gone, long gone, because that is something that people from a place of privilege can say. It's almost like when we talk about racism and people feel like, you know, I don't have to have that conversation with my kids. It's because you're coming from a place of privilege. And so there is a lot of gaslighting when it comes to casteism, because within our South Asian communities, people who have always had that caste privilege tend to just not see it while they are still benefiting from it.
Yeah, that's such an important point, and I'm really glad you said that. So you talked about the Dalit or the Untouchables, kind of this group who's considered to be the sort of the lowest caste when you think about the caste system. So what does it mean to be an Untouchable? What would life look like for someone who would have that caste designation?
Yeah, so I mean, I can tell you from a very personal place. So what that meant for, I would say, from my father's side of the family, my grandfather at that time, two generations ago, untouchables or Dalits were not allowed to go into classrooms. If you wanted to study, you had to sit outside of a classroom. They weren't really allowed to go into any public place. They weren't allowed to go in the homes of people of upper castes. They weren't allowed to go into temples, places of worship. And so for most lower caste people, they didn't get to study. My grandfather, actually, on my mother's side, was very much about education. And he actually, surprisingly, he learned to read and write sitting outside of a classroom because he was not allowed in the classroom. Even then, you know, Dalits were considered so dirty that if an upper caste person walked by, they had to put their head down in the soil because even their shadows are considered dirty. And then I think about in my father's generation, that was the era of segregation. So he was allowed to go to school, but he had to sit at the back of the classroom. He was not actually called by his name. He was called BC, which means backwards class. And he had to cut the during like student roll call. He had to stand for BC. He wasn't even given a name at school, wasn't allowed to drink the water, which to me was like a very disturbing image to think of. You know, my dad's lips were considered so dirty that he had to sort of just like reach for water while somebody's pouring it into his mouth. And so that a lot of that is still remains in India, but a lot of those feelings and ideals have transferred over to all of these people who are immigrating all across the diaspora. And I felt it. I have never lived a day in India. I was born in England. I grew up in Canada. Yet caste is something that was constantly in conversations. And interestingly enough, it was never talk about lower caste. It was all was about boasting your upper caste or boasting your place of privilege in society. And you'll see it today. Look online. You'll see the Brahmin, which is the most upper caste, the Brahmin Society of Canada, of the United States, of Ontario, of Toronto. So there's very much this pride in caste, in privileged caste. But at the same time, people are saying it doesn't exist. Then why do these societies still exist?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening right now are feeling kind of enlightened about this situation. And just the fact that, you know, that people who live in other countries, like here in Canada, are experiencing this. And just, you know, what you said about what it meant to be an untouchable for your grandfather, for your father. I mean, I think it really paints a picture of how it impacted their everyday lives and mm-hmm. put them at a disadvantage in so many ways. So do you remember when you first started hearing about these experiences?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was always like I had a large circle of South Asian friends, like my best friends, even today, a big group of South Asian friends. I attended language classes, Gujarati language classes. I went to the temple, but I would hear it all the time, even like from my schoolmates, like from a young age. Hey, what caste are you, or what's your last name? Because that puts you into, you know, a caste category. Or at the temple, you know, different aunties would be like, well, what caste are you? And I remember from a young child, my mom would always brush away. She's like, we don't believe in that. You know, we're just people of God. But then when I was 15 years old and my parents finally told us, we didn't know anything about what caste we were, because our parents always just raised us, we don't believe in that. But when I was 15 years old, my parents sat me down and they said, we have, you know, something serious to tell you. And they told my brother and I that we were born as untouchables. And then it started to click. All of those conversations I had heard, they started to come back to me. And I thought, this is part of everyday life and everyday conversations. And I think I struggled with it the most in my 20s. I mean, it's a hard time for everybody as a South Asian, you know, everybody is on you. Like, when are you getting married? And, you know, you weren't allowed to date this whole time, but all of a sudden now it's like, go find that guy and get married.
Yes, I feel that.
Right. And the aunties would be matchmaking and they would always say, oh, we found this good boy from a good family. And meaning that, you know, and they would even say what caste he's from. And up until that point, I had not told a soul. I had told nobody about this. I didn't really know how to process it. And in my mind, I would think, but I'm not a good girl. I'm considered dirty and filthy and the lowest of the low. And so it really plays on you. And it really, really affected my self-esteem. And I felt like I knew the caste of all of my friends because they all are from upper caste, but nobody knew who I was, and sort of felt like I was very much, they call it like in the caste closet, because you're almost, this is who I am, but I'm fearful of revealing that identity. And so many people here in Canada do not want to reveal their, it's very difficult to get people to speak about it. And I understand why, because there are real consequences to that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, especially when you're talking about how it impacts, you know, how your even your friends would see you, or how a potential partner would consider you. I mean, and this is a huge turning point in your life, because before this, you'd heard, you know, people talking about caste, but you kind of followed, like, which makes sense, what your family mm-hmm. was saying, which is, you know, we don't believe in that. And now you kind of have this secret, right? Mm-hmm. After your parents tell you. So when did you decide that it was important to start speaking out about this?
So actually, right off the bat, when I was 15, I said, we need to say something. And my mom especially was, no, we don't talk at all. She was very scared. Looking back now, I understand where that fear was coming from. But she told me, she said, Mira, if you tell anyone, she goes, do you know, and she named names of family friends, because she's like, do you know X, Y, and Z will never speak to us again? And I thought, why do we want to be around these people if they'll never speak to us again? But I didn't understand at that point. For my parents, they had come to a new country where not only were they facing racism and discrimination from outside, it would also be happening to them within their community that they had built, and all they had were their friends. And so I understand that now, but I had always wanted to speak about it, but I had my turning point actually when I was, not until I was 38 years old, and that happened with a very close friend of mine. We had been friends for 20 years. We had both just had babies. She had gone to India to use a surrogate, and I had gone with my mom to her house to see the babies. Her mother was there as well. And it was supposed to be this really fun time for us. But as a journalist, I always, you know, I have questions in my mind. And I had read somewhere that surrogates in India of a lower caste are paid less, like significantly less. And I was mortified by that idea. And I wanted to ask her. Mind you, at this point, nobody knows what caste I am. And so I had asked her in conversation, because she was telling me about the surrogacy process. And I said, I heard this about lower caste surrogates. Is this true? And she's so like nonchalant. She's like, yeah, of course. She's like, I would never have a lower caste surrogate. I don't want a stupid kid. And she said it, and it was like a punch to my gut, because she's looking at me and basically she's saying that about me, and I can see my child and I see my mom. And it's like, even telling, like, I welled up with emotion, and I'm like, who are you? We have been friends for 20 years and you don't know who I am, and I don't know who you are. And so we got in the car, and right then I said to my mom, I said, I can't stay silent anymore. I have to talk about it. And that was the first time. And I think she saw it, because now I have a child who is going to be raised in this as well. She was like, do what you have to do and say what you want to say. And since then, I have been.
Wow. So did you have a conversation with that friend? Was that the first step?
That, you know what, to this date, and it's been several years now, we have never had a conversation about it again. It's sort of just been glossed over. We are not very close friends anymore. We're like acquaintances, but she's never approached me to have that conversation. It's just so painful and difficult for me. I don't want to broach it myself.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally fair. And I feel like in this situation, it would make sense for her to be the one to initiate that, especially after you have shared your story so publicly. So mm-hmm. once you had this realization that it was something you wanted to talk about, obviously you're a journalist and a media personality, but what was that first step? What did that look like for you?
So the first step, actually, it was a really emotional first step. So it was 2019, and I was one of the speakers at a Women's Day event put on by the Southern African Embrace. I actually have to say, the Black community has been so supportive of this, much more than people within my own community, which is a sad, but it is a telling truth. And so I was doing this keynote speech at this Women's Day event, and I knew it was all about identity, and I wanted to weave caste into that. And so I actually invited my dad to come, because my dad really helped me out with, you know, writing all of this. And I learned so much more of my dad's experience as well. And so it was a room full of women and my father. He was the only man in the room. And it's the first time I openly spoke about our family's experience with caste. And the moment I started speaking, I just broke down, and I could see my father was weeping the entire time, because I think it was for him the first time he felt heard. He felt silenced for so long. And so when I finished, everybody actually stood up and they went, looked toward my dad, and they gave my dad a standing ovation. And I think that was one of the most meaningful moments ever. And I think it started that healing for my father and I as well.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, to have kept that hidden for so long, and it would be stressful too, I'm sure, for your parents, thinking they could lose all of their friends if they found out about this. I imagine, yeah, there was this element of relief and release. And like you talk about being seen and heard, there's so much power in that after feeling hidden for so long.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is that fear, because when I am choosing to talk about this, at the same time, I am, I'm also outing, so to speak, my family, all of my family, my extended family, and maybe they're not ready for that. And it's not because they're cowards. It's because there is real consequences to that. And so sometimes I feel guilty about this as well, which I shouldn't, but it affects so many more people than myself. And I know it's such a big issue still, because I have, the way I was feeling when I was 20, I have a 20-year-old, a cousin in her 20s in England, and she will call anytime she sees that I've spoken about this on TV, the radio, or written something, she will call me in tears, because she says, this is how I feel right now. I can't tell my friends. I don't know how to say it. You know, people are trying to play matchmaker with me, and I don't know how to say this. And so it's still going on in the States. There's the first lawsuit that is going to the Supreme Court. It is happening in workplaces. I've heard from new immigrants here saying that when they, you know, apply for a housing application, caste is listed on there. So people are lying about their caste because they want to just get housing. It's happening right here, and we need to talk about it. And one thing I want to be very clear about is it shouldn't just be people of a lower caste like myself that talk about it. It needs to be everybody that speaks about it. It's just like with racism. We don't expect the people who that are facing racism, we don't expect, say, for example, the Black community to be the ones to fix everything. We need the people who are doing all that damage to fix things.
Yes.
And I get heated, but because it seems so, it's such a simple thing to grasp, yet nobody seems nobody wants to touch it.
Yeah. I mean, like allyship for, especially, you know, when we think about racism, you're right. It's so important, and it really is the solution, a big step in the way to solving the problem. So it makes sense that in this situation, it would be the same thing. You need allies from different parts of the community to really step up. Have you seen any of that since you started sharing your story?
I have to say very little. I mean, we know like silence speaks volumes as well, right? So, you know, on say, for example, social media, I'm quite active, and I will see, you know, within the South Asian community, the people who, you know, are following me regularly, like and comment on my posts. If it is anything to do with caste, nothing. And I've noticed that pattern from so many people within the community. And so that silence speaks volumes, because either they don't like what I'm saying, or they don't want to have other people knowing that they like what I'm saying. And so that allyship isn't there, and it should be. And I remember during the George Floyd protests, and so many South Asians were, you know, Black Lives Matter, and rightfully so. We needed to be allies, and we've been wrong in so many ways when it comes to anti-Black racism. But I saw so much hypocrisy in that, because I thought, how can you stand there and say Black Lives Matter, but not care about the people within your own community? And you are doing exactly that to these people. It is a form of apartheid.
Yeah. And it's, you know, racism and discrimination within our own community too. Mm-hmm. You know, I know you said that earlier, and I think that's something that we also don't talk a lot about. You know, we think about racism being against a community as a whole or discrimination, but we don't talk about these, especially, you know, casteism is an example of that, of this discrimination that can exist within communities. So when you talk about allyship and how other people can help, what can that look like for people who do want to support this cause of really eliminating that system?
I think first and foremost, just admitting that it exists, right? Because there's so much gaslighting that, no, this isn't a problem anymore. This is something old, like, you know, it doesn't happen anymore. And especially if you are somebody that has a platform. So I've told this story before. It was at Toronto International Film Festival, and Priyanka Chopra was one of the special guests. She was, you know, had a big in the auditorium with Cameron Boyd Bailey. They had to sit down like one-on-one, and somebody in the audience, it was a white gentleman in the front row, said, you know, I've heard about this caste thing, you know, can you tell me what it is? And she like she's like, no, that's just in the villages of India. That doesn't exist anymore. That's long gone. And I was like this, like I was like getting out of my seat because I was ready to say like, you know, just respectfully, I'd like to disagree with you and explain why. But then all of the, you know, there was a slew of South Asians there and they all began clapping. And so I just sort of sat back down and I felt like for her, that could have been a moment of education. She has a huge platform and she could have used that to tell people, yes, this exists and yes, we need to stop it. And I don't think there was malice in what she was saying. I think there was ignorance there and not realizing that this caste privilege exists.
It must have been challenging to be in the audience, obviously, to know what you know and to have your own experience and then to just see this missed opportunity from someone with a big platform who really could have said something about this and really shed some light on it for a wider audience.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's sort of, it just speaks to that whole caste privilege, right? When you might not be intending to cause harm, like there's intent and then there's impact, but the impact is you actually are causing harm because what that's doing when you say that it doesn't exist for people who don't know about it, you're really gaslighting all of those people who are going through it in those very moments. So I almost feel like when you ask me that question, you know, what could people do? Instead of, yes, it's great if people support, you know, say when I've written a story or spoken about it or anyone else that is doing these things, but it would be great if it wasn't so reactive. I would love some proactive action from people, not just within our South Asian community. And I don't want it to come off that, you know, I have something against the community. I love my community. I'm very culturally involved. But, you know, beyond the South Asian community, just as good human beings, I would love that more people paid attention to this and they were proactive in researching and looking into this and finding these stories.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense that would make a huge difference. It's interesting because obviously I'm South Asian as well. I actually grew up in Regina, Saskatchewan, and I didn't have a lot of South Asian friends or people around me in general. It was not a very diverse city at the time. Mm-hmm. And my family is not Hindu, but I'd heard about the caste system, but I think it exists differently for different religious communities mm-hmm. as well. But I still remember going back to India for the first time just to visit my extended family and all of them talking about my skin color mm-hmm. And how, oh, you were so fair when you were little and now your skin's so dark mm-hmm. and you were so much more beautiful before. And I was so confused having like not experienced any of this mm-hmm. at home. And so I think that when I was reading your story as a South Asian person, I felt very ignorant myself that I had not heard about this. And so I think what you're doing by sharing your experience and your family's story is raising awareness even within our own community mm. for people who aren't aware of this, because there is still a lot of secrecy around these mm. conversations.
There is a lot of secrecy. And at the same time, I think, you know, with the world becoming smaller and so many more people, you know, from India moving to different parts of the world, I look at it now even. There are so many people that will reach out to me on social media and say, you know, hey, I'm a newcomer. I live in Halifax. I live here. I live there. And this is what's happening to me. And because more and more South Asians are coming to different parts of the diaspora, it seems like it's almost on the rise and people are scared to come out about their caste because there seems to be like this like freedom to speak so openly in denigrating people of lower caste. And if you look, I mean, COVID was very, very harsh for people, especially in India, because, you know, there was this whole thing about, you know, social distancing and germs and all of this. But if you think about it, people of the lower caste who have those jobs, they were like the cleaning jobs of the hospital and the cleaning of the toilets and basically the, you know, the roads and things that, all of those things that we suddenly clicked, these are the most important things. But the people that were doing it in India were treated worse than ever. They were like doused with bleach. They were like put to a different part of towns and villages. And just, it was horrible for them, even though they were the ones that were keeping things going. And I think some of that, a lot of that mentality has spread along with COVID. And there is very much, no, you stay over there type of mentality, even here, like I told you, with housing and in schooling and in the workplace as well.
When you mentioned that, the lawsuit you mentioned in the US about someone who experienced discrimination at work based on their caste, and then also on housing applications, I think these are, it's really important to note that this is impacting the way people in our own country live their lives and what they have access to. Mm-hmm. So what about you yourself? I mean, since you started sharing this, talking about your family's caste, have you experienced any negative reactions or any discrimination?
Yes, you should have a look at my DMs. No. There have been some nasty messages. A lot of it, unfortunately, is from men, and things tend to get misogynistic very quickly. And suddenly it becomes about my appearance and I'm not very smart because I'm a woman, and it goes down that path. But there's also a lot of just hateful comments in terms of, you know, what you're saying is not true and you're spreading mistruths. And that's where like that gaslighting comes in. On the flip side, there has been a lot of support as well. And so I'm very grateful for that. And like I said, the Black community, the African community has very, very much embraced this cause. And so I'm really, really grateful for that and in them helping to raise awareness for that. And then there's great like South Asian media companies. Like, for example, like I wrote my story in Untold, which was put together a book of, it's like a anthology of stories. It's, I highly recommend people read this, of different stories from women in the, and men in the South Asian diaspora. And so mine is one of those stories. And so there have been really, really great allies. So yeah, it's a mix. I guess like anything, when you're going to be speaking truth to power, there's going to be some pushback.
Yeah, well, you've certainly done a lot to raise awareness just by sharing your own story. And we have to talk about, you know, Fuchsia Media and what you do as well, because I think, I mean, being a woman of color in the journalism industry in Canada is not easy. I've also experienced it as mm-hmm. well. But you really took this leap of faith and launched your own company. So tell me more about what led to that.
So it wasn't so much a leap of faith, because this was back when, even I remember when I was going to university, I had really, really wanted to study journalism. And at that time, my dad said, like, I'm in my 40s, right? So that was quite a long time ago. And my dad said, don't do it. You're a smart girl. There are no colored people on TV. Do something smart. So I went to business school and I still had that passion inside of me. So I ended up actually going back and doing a second degree, and I got my journalism degree as well. But I found that there really wasn't interest in having me at that time. And so instead, I just started something of my own. And I feel like, sadly, that's always been the path for me. Like, I'm very proud of all these things I've built, but it's always out of that necessity, because mainstream media doesn't want me. Like, I've successfully also built two radio shows on mainstream radio stations, but I've never been offered that opportunity for existing. Like, I've never been seen as mainstream. So I've never been offered those same opportunities on something that is existing, something that is mainstream. I'm just seen as niche, which is unfortunate. I'm very proud that I have been able to do these things, but there is something disheartening in that as well.
I can totally see why, especially because you've more than proven. You've done more than what most people would do to get a job or to show that, you know, they have the skills needed to be successful mm-hmm. in that role. What is your goal with Fuchsia Media? I mean, it's providing obviously content that we're not seeing in the mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly it. And it's like, I don't like to say giving a voice to the voiceless because we all have voices, but many of those voices are silenced. And so, you know, the next big thing we're doing right now, which is in its very early phases, is we're, you know, starting to work with a production company. I'm actually writing my very first screenplay. Because I do want to take that cast conversation even further into film. And so that's sort of our next foray. You know, we went from print media to digital media to radio and podcasting. And now we're sort of going to start into the film space as well.
That is absolutely incredible. And I mean, when you started Fuchsia Media, is that something you thought would happen down the road?
No, I never. I just was like, I want to write some stories that people will relate to and resonate with them that I'm not seeing anywhere else. And, you know, I packaged it up when I started Fuchsia. That's what was print was big and, you know, those glossy magazines. And I said, yeah, I'm going to have this glossy fashion and beauty magazine, but I'm going to inside of those pages have all of these deep digging stories and taboo stories that nobody's talking about, but they'll pick it up because it's a pretty little magazine. And that's what happened. And it was great. It was a great time, but then print went away, as we know.
Yes. And I mean, now obviously you're innovating and that's very cool to hear that kind of film might be the next iteration of this. So I'll definitely have to keep following you and seeing where you go with that. Maybe you'll have another turning point. Who knows?
Oh yeah. The sequel.
Yes, exactly. You know, we talked a lot about allyship and about how people can really help to raise awareness about casteism. Mm-hmm. I wonder, as you kind of reflect back on your turning point and, you know, those decades of silence, of having to hide this secret after you found out as a teenager, like, what would you say to people who are in that position that you were in, where they're still, you know, embarrassed or they're, you know, they're still having to hide this from the people around them?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough one. I just think it is to know your worth. Know that you shape your identity, your actions shape your identity. It is not what society places on you. It is all what is inside of here. And I wish I had done more of that in my early years, but I just think, just know your worth.
That's a really important message. Are there groups for people, like support groups or anything like that, for people who might find themselves feeling isolated because of this?
You know, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything like that. I will say things are shifting. I'm actually working with the University of British Columbia on a study. It's a project called Cast Canada, and they're doing a symposium in the spring as well. So more and more things, especially in educational institutions, are starting to happen because people are saying, like, I need help. I need somebody to speak with. And it's hard as well because in our community, sometimes, you know, things like therapy and outside help are shunned upon. So it's hard for people to find these resources. So I'm glad that at least at the educational level, it's starting. It's slow and things take time, but at least it's starting.
Yes, absolutely. Just important to see that it's getting some recognition and that it's mm-hmm. being elevated. Like that is something that, you know, that we need to be aware of and that we need to understand is impacting people. Mm-hmm. Mira, thank you so much for just sharing your story and all of your insights today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's really important to me and I'm really glad we had this conversation.
Yes, me too. And where can people find you if they want to continue following you after this?
Yeah, for sure. On Instagram at mira.estrada. That's usually where I'm most active, or on the website fusionmedia.ca.
Perfect. All right. Thank you again so much, Mira.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. And thank you to all of you for watching and listening today. If you want to find me on social media, I'm at Priya Sam. Send me a DM. Let me know what you thought of the episode. I love hearing from you. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review as well on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, take good care of yourselves and of each other.